COVID-19 has revealed shortcomings in the health systems of countries all over the world. In sub-Saharan Africa, the health crisis threatens to severely curtail already limited public health services and exacerbate fragility. Yet, despite immense hurdles, past crises have shown that innovative decision-making and locally led interventions can go a long way in improving health systems. You're listening to Friday Podcasts from the Environmental Change and Security Program and the Maternal Health Initiative at the Wilson Center. In this special series, Africa in Transition, produced with support from the Population Institute, we share insights from experts and practitioners focused on creating an enabling environment in sub-Saharan Africa for a peaceful and prosperous future. I'm Lauren Reese, and in today's episode, we share Dr. Raj Punjabi's remarks at a recent Africa in Transition event focused on the role of locally led interventions in improving the resilience and responsiveness of health systems in sub-Saharan Africa. CEO of Last Mile Health and Assistant Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School, Dr. Punjabi draws from his experience responding to Ebola in West Africa to illustrate that the best health system is an everyday system that can surge in a crisis. Investing in community health workers, says Dr. Punjabi, is not simply an investment in health. It's an investment in livelihoods, economic prosperity, and security.
Outbreaks start and stop in communities. We've heard that already. And the role of community health workers, as we heard from my brother, Dr. Muhammad, are just absolutely vital. And it was true for the everyday epidemics. It's even more true during pandemics. Ambassador Malik and I actually, like many of you, saw this firsthand in West Africa. And I want to make this point about patient zero, Emil, who was a two-year-old in December of 2013 in the forest of southern Guinea, who fell sick with vomiting, fever, and diarrhea. And his parents and family thought that may have been the run-of-the-mill type of condition. But then he died a few days later, and his mother died, and his sisters died. And this disease spread like wildfire from one village to another. And it wasn't until 3 months later, in March 2014, that the world recognized this epidemic of Ebola. When every minute had counted, we know that months passed before we mobilized a response. Several more months passed as this disease spread through my country and the ones near it, Sierra Leone and Guinea. Well, it was in that moment when we were told that over a million people could become infected. This was before the vaccine was available, that most of those people would die. When we had nearly lost all hope, it was local community health workers teaming up with frontline nurses who, when Ebola threatened to bring humanity to its knees, stood up, learned the signs and symptoms of Ebola, went door to door with doctors to find the sick and get them into care. And as you heard from Ambassador Malik so eloquently, they were critical for helping halt this epidemic and stop it in its tracks. We've learned a few things from these workers. We've learned that the courage, the love, the connection of people to their own communities is an incredibly vital asset that we all depend on because it's effective, but also because it allows us to move quickly. And if there's anything about an epidemic, is speed matters. And so does investing in people closest to the problem. That is the root of resilience, as we've learned from those community health workers then and the many that have responded to epidemics across Africa. The second thing we learned from the West Africa Ebola epidemic and what we're learning now from COVID is that epidemics don't only threaten our immune systems, they can devastate our health systems. This is actual data, not projections from that time. And I emphasize that to say, because we had also made, all of us, projections that this would happen. And then it happened. 140% of malaria cases amongst children went untreated across Liberia. And there was an increase in maternal deaths across that region. This is happening now again during COVID, but it doesn't have to be this way if we are investing, as Uzma so eloquently said, every day in these programs. This is the power of what could have happened in Ebola and what can happen now during COVID, as different as those two epidemics are. facility-based delivery, skilled birth attendance across Liberia dropped. It wasn't very high in the first place at the time in 2014, slightly above 50%, but it plummeted threefold during the epidemic because our health workers were becoming infected, our health systems had poor infection control, and people were afraid to go to the hospital because they were afraid they'd get infected. In fact, we documented this in a study. If you were even in a low transmission area for Ebola, and you were a mother, an expectant mother, and you believed you could get an infection from a health worker in a health center, you were about 50% less likely to go to that hospital for your birth. That didn't have to be this way. In places where the Liberian government had already invested in hiring, training, and equipping community health workers, linking them with primary health centers, ensuring they are supported by nurses to provide routine everyday care, the government was able to adapt its protocols. It didn't say, tell the workers to stop working. It provided them with protection. It didn't tell the workers to sit back. It actually provided them with the payment they needed. It didn't tell them to sit back. It provided them with the training and support they needed. And they were able to sustain facility-based deliveries and treatment for sick children with conditions like malaria in those areas. The importance of persistence, not to repeat this vicious cycle of panic and then neglect, but a virtuous cycle of commitment and effectiveness and impact, is what the Liberian government stayed focused on after our epidemic came under control. Ambassador Malik played an essential role in this, as in supporting the leadership of the country, President Sirleaf at the time, who made a commitment that she would deploy a health worker, community health worker within reach of every last community in the country. That was about 4,000 workers in the country. And she made that commitment to do it before she left office, to deploy half of those. And President Weah has continued with his government. Those workers have provided everyday health care. They've provided treatment for children. They've provided prenatal care. But importantly, they've also continued, and the first thing they were trained on was event-based surveillance. And we've seen that again and again. When we have the eyes and ears of the health system closest to the people, we can have a stronger emergency system. And that might be the other big lesson we learn from these workers and this experience, that the best emergency systems aren't emergency systems per se. The best emergency systems are everyday systems that can surge at times of crises. This is relevant today, as many of my colleagues have already said. When you've seen one pandemic, as we say in public health, you've seen one pandemic or one epidemic. COVID's very different than Ebola, but there are some similar approaches that are critical. The first challenge in COVID is, how do you achieve rapid and sustained viral suppression? This is from our colleagues at Resolve to Save Lives. And we know that the work of testing and tracing and treatment and isolation, as my colleague Mohammed said, is vital. Juliet repeated that. We need to build those systems. Community health workers are critical for that. The second is, how do we prevent primary healthcare system collapse? You heard about the projections of COVID from USMA. There are also other projections that show the impact on disruptions from COVID on primary healthcare, including a 30 to 40% increase in low and middle income countries, many of them in Africa, from excess child and maternal death, non-COVID conditions. But it doesn't have to be this way. If we invest in the people closest to the problem, if we build those everyday systems every day and surge them during times of emergency, then you can see results. Across Africa, this is from scientific papers, those countries like South Africa who invested in these workers, they had about 27,000 HIV and TB community health workers who they retrained. They went on to screen and help detect COVID at the community level, screening over 11 million people, about 20% of the population in the first months of their pandemic. In Ethiopia, their legendary health extension worker program has provided primary health care. And during the COVID pandemic, those community health workers have traced thousands and tens of thousands of people to ensure that they are connected with rapid response teams. And they've leveraged digital technology on training for contact tracing and infection control to do that work. And in Liberia, the place that I just mentioned had made those investments after Ebola. When this next pandemic is hit, kids have not gone untreated for malaria. In fact, we're doing an analysis now in support of the government that shows one out of two rural children in the country with malaria are being tested and treated by their neighbors, by community health workers who are paid and supported and supervised. And that treatment has been sustained during the pandemic. All of that treatment is continuing. In fact, it's slightly more than what's even being delivered at the healthcare facility level now. So my call to action to this group, because I know there are many in this community that are watching, that are in the security community, the international development community, they go beyond our global health community. I have a plea and a call to action to offer. We need your help to make the case that investing in these community health workers, as Mohammed so said eloquently, is not simply a health issue. And because that is so plainly clear now, it has devastated our health systems, our economies. It's been an issue of national security. At this moment, when we have the political leadership more engaged than they have ever been, the Bureau of Africa Heads of State meets every few weeks now on this issue. At this particular moment, we need your help to do one major thing, to shift the idea that these workers should be volunteers and informal. Most of these community health workers are women. Most of them are from poor communities, and they go unpaid. We have a guild mentality that tells us that these workers should remain underrecognized and undervalued. We'll ask them to volunteer when it's needed, and that is devastating. We have framed that as a healthcare issue because we know when we pay these workers and you support them with the supervision, you get better health results, but you also get better protection of livelihoods during a crisis like this, as you've seen. So what we need is to get behind the Africa Union's effort to scale up 1 million community health workers. What we need your help on is to push for these workers to be employed as a job creation activity. We should not be increasing domestic financing of healthcare simply from healthcare budgets. And what we need is investing fiscal stimulus packages. We should invest security budgets into this kind of a workforce because it delivers for the economy and the security of nations. I'll make one simple point here. The UN Economic Commission for Africa pointed how within reach this is. The UN Economic Commission for Africa put out an analysis in April that showed at least $100 billion of fiscal stimulus would be needed to support the economic recovery in Africa and mitigation. There have been some debt relief that's also been passed. Just 2 to 4%, just 2 to 4% of that minimum number of $100 billion would help Mohammed help the member states fund this workforce, this potential pandemic health force that could help us not only deal with this pandemic, but be better prepared for the next one.
You've been listening to Friday Podcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.